Well, thank you very much, Arnie, for this very nice introduction, and thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to be here. It's very nice. So my lab is interested in the molecular mechanisms of organismal longevity. And as you can see here, as we age, the onset of a wide variety of diseases, in particular neurodegenerative disorders such as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, strikingly increase. So an important question is to understand if aging itself is a regulated process, and if it is, if understanding the regulation of aging can help us have some insight into maybe a common mechanism that's behind a wide range of age-related disorders. Now, for a long time, aging was thought to be not regulated and was just thought to be the byproduct of regular wear and tear. But this view has drastically changed, and it is now thought that aging and longevity are both regulated by genes and also by the environment. And during my talk today, I'm going to try to present you two evidence on the role of genes in longevity, but also the role of the environment in longevity. So that longevity is regulated probably by specific genes comes from the very simple observation that very different species have very various lifespan or very various longevity. But within each species, all the individuals have approximately the same lifespan, indicating that there are probably species-specific genes that control the longevity that goes from very short days in the worms to quite long, several decades in humans, and can be like 150 years for turtles, for instance. Now, that longevity is indeed has indeed genetic components is further supported by observation studies in families in which siblings have an exceptional longevity done by the group of Tom Pearce. So in those families, you can see here, that's an example of a pedigree where 9 out of the 10 siblings are centenarians and both parents were centenarians. So by analyzing those families with human genetics approaches, the group of Tom Pearce have shown that extreme longevity, being a centenarian, is indeed regulated by a genetic process, and those studies have also identified clusters of genes that are associated with extreme longevity, again being a centenarian, and those genes map on chromosome 4 and on chromosome 19. Now, those clusters contain many genes, and so far, the specific genes in those clusters that are responsible for these exceptional longevities are not known yet. Now, as you've seen in the past few days, a big breakthrough in understanding specific genes that can control organismal longevity have come from studies in a model organism, the nematode Cinerabitis elegans. And studies by the group of Cynthia Kenyon and the group of Gary Rufkin have identified worm mutants that can live 3 times longer as normal worms. And not only do those worms live longer, but they are also youthful for a longer period of time, indicating that that's their youthful period that's extended, not their decline period, which is good. And it turned out that the mutant that lived long were mutated in a gene encoding the insulin receptor. So those long-lived mutants were mutated in the insulin receptor. So you probably all know by now what insulin does. So insulin, by binding to its tyrosine kinase receptor, the insulin receptor, triggers the activation of a cascade of protein within cells, so a lipid kinase, PFP kinase, that then leads to the phosphorylation of lipids at the inner surface of the plasma membranes, and those newly generated phospholipids trigger the recruitment and consecutive activation of a series of protein kinases within cells, including AKT and a related protein kinase called SGK. Now, it turned out that not only the insulin receptor mutant, but also mutants that were mutated in the insulin signaling pathways, when there was loss of function in those mutants, this led to an increase in longevity, not only in worms, but also in yeast and in the flies. So there is a conservation of these insulin pathways, at least in invertebrates, for controlling longevity when mutated. Now, what about mammals? Well, recent studies by the group of Yves Lebouc in France and by the group of One can, at the Joslin Institute, have indicated that in mice that are mutant for the insulin receptor, or mice that are mutant for a related receptor, the insulin-like growth factor 1 receptor, those mice also live longer than normal mice, both in terms of average longevity, but also in terms of maximal longevity. And this extension of longevity due to the mutation in the IGF-1 receptor is not at the expense of other phenotypes. Those mice have a normal growth, and those mice are fertile. Now, the other phenotype that's associated with this increased longevity are at least two other phenotypes. One is that those mice have a decrease in age-dependent disease that normally plague mice, like cancer. They are less prone to cancer, that's one. And two, those mice display also resistance to oxidative stress stimuli. And this is important in light of the observation that resistance to oxidative stress is highly coupled with extension of longevity, not only in mice, but in a wide range of species, and may even be part of the mechanisms by which longevity is extended, this increase in resistance to oxidative stress. Yeah.
In an experiment like this, about how many mice do they use?
So here they didn't use as many mice as you're supposed to use for this kind of analysis. They probably use like around like 30, 40 mice. Apparently, like people have calculated, there's this guy Rich Miller who studies like the statistics of longevity and how big the cohort needs to be such that the results are really statistically significant. And you need to have about like more than 70 animals. So it's not really at the level where you can be 100% confident here, but it's indicative.
Sure. So one more question: the human genes that sort of got clustered on 9 and whatever, do they have anything to do with this?
So people have gone the other way and sort of like say, well, now there's this clusters in chromosome 4 and chromosome 19. Are they at least genes coding for the insulin receptor, IGF, IGF-1 receptor, or PI3 kinase, AKT? There is nothing that relates as far as first glance.
And one even more interesting question, which is that, and I guess it's polygenic, so you can't even ask that, but is this cluster in some sense dominant? Or in the sense that if these people marry someone else, right. I'm really interested.
Yeah, so they can, it's really hard, like everything is post, because you need to know the time
people
of death.
People don't know about children of these people.
So, yeah. Okay. And also, it's really,
yes. Okay.
So it's harder to do like from like a disease, for instance, that affect like young kids, where you can really do like rapidly pedigrees. Here you sort of like have to work backward, and it's a little bit more difficult. Also because, and we'll talk about that later, there is a very strong environmental component of longevity, and it's possible that someone would have lived 110, but if like this person either like was smoking, and that's kind of like an environment, or even like died in an accident, that just completely perturbs the
study.
Yes.
Because I think that people have tried to reproduce it and have a lot of trouble.
Yeah, so it's very controversial because, when you talk to, this summer I was at the aging conference, and Steve Ostad, who is like one of the big figures in the aging field, he was saying that, yes, indeed, like people have been having trouble seeing whether it's something general or whether it's something like particular. And the fact that they find like those clusters of chromosome 4, they don't find that in every family, every pedigree of centenarians. They find that in a family that's from Italian descent, and the chromosome 19 is from a family that's from Scandinavian descent. So it's possible that also you have some genes that are also linked, maybe linked to the environment, but also probably linked to the population that you were studying. And now the question is, how do you sort that out?
That's a big problem.
Yes.
So as soon as you have allele frequencies that are different in case and controls, it looks like you get significance when you're not when you're comparing apples and oranges.
Exactly.
And that's one of the reasons why most journals now are insisting on 2 independent case studies.
Yes.
And that wasn't the
no, that no, no. So, no, no, no. And so what's interesting now is that you need to have somehow access to a pool of centenarians, and those are not like super frequent. So actually, one of my neighbor in the Department of Genetics at Stanford University, this guy Luca Cavalli-Soda, who was working on language, sort of like population genetics, he now has access to a large population of centenarians in China, and just because of numbers, there are more centenarians.
Could you go back slightly? You did a couple of slides where you showed the population in at large dying off in a. First slide, I guess it was. So that's deaths per 100,000, right? I'm going to sort of look for an average here. I guess the question I'm getting at is, do you need centenarians? Centenarians would be an extreme phenotype, three sigma off of the curve here, right? Can you do this watch where the curves go up exponentially like they do in many, well, in this case it's a lot, yeah, so they go up exponentially, and ask the question, is there a natural cutoff where that happens? I mean, if that was cancer, it would look like Alzheimer's, right? If it really goes up 1,000.
Well, so what's interesting
years,
though, and this is something that I, is that, yeah, well, the thing is that if you start looking after like 80 years old, you start having like those weird case in terms of, if you look at the incidence of disease, obviously like everything, if you plot everything, it will increase. But if you look at like, so if basically you're 85 year old and you haven't had cancer by 85, right, chances are that you're not going to get cancer. Yeah. And if you're 90 and you've not been diagnosed yet with Alzheimer's, chances are that you're not going to get Alzheimer's. So it actually goes, there are actually peaks in terms of the
rate of increase of each disease changes as a function of age.
Yes.
Which complicates
the time
you want to
look at. And that's
age is a funny variable, which is the sum of all those variables.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And this is also what makes it, well, it's what makes it an exciting phenotype, because it's not a program, it's more stochastic, and also, yeah, it's the integration of multiple traits, and then, well, I guess the end result of aging is death, right, but it's not only that, it's sort of like, what are there some genes that make the organisms just more frail, so that then it just becomes susceptible to a wide range of diseases, or is it that just like the disease make the organism more frail and then wind up dying?
So there ought to be a group of genes which have disease specificity and another group which you just described, which are generalized genes that have impact.
Yes.
And that would make the genetics very complex.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think at some point, having more data, it's going to be able, like, I think people, like, human geneticists are probably with bigger cohorts, being able to distinguish between disease genes from longevity or aging genes.
There are very large cohorts. The nurses study, the women study, that those are cohorts of 133,000 individuals who have a very strong age distribution, and that you almost need that in the end.
But sort of continuing on Arne's point, it seems like that if you come to the late 70s or something, although you have to work hard to get statistical significance, you have a larger pool of people, right? So as you come down from 100 to lower and lower ages, there's one effect that, you know, you still, okay, could have, you know, just lived long, guys, by chance. On the other hand, the population size is bigger, right? So one might have been able to set up a more clever statistical test that tests things at 70s, 80s, rather than there must be an optimal setting of ages.
It is true. I think the one reason why people chose centenarian is the same reason why people in the worms chose long-lived worms, is that if you have something that makes the organism long-lived, it may not be representing everything that's going on, but at least you sort of like a little bit escape this problem of the disease versus the normal aging, and you know that the people who have extreme longevity are going to have.
Okay, but all of this depends on, I mean, all these distributions, as you rightly point out, there's some mixture of distributions of people with different genetic predispositions, right? And so what you're hoping is when you go to the 100-year-olds,
All of
the other distributions, they're so far in the tail, you don't get these guys anymore. You only get the guys But you don't really know, because you don't really know what those distributions are. Right?
The
other value of centenarians, actually, is their children are 70. And their children are 40. And so you really can get in a family, if you can trace it back and they want to cooperate, four generations, which is very valuable genetically. To look at segregation of wheels and things like that. Why? Centenarians do have real value. But I'm trying to get at the question because it came right out of your slides, and this one especially. How much, everything in what you learn in all of genetics is everything is in picking the phenotype. Mm-hmm. If you pick a clean phenotype, you can get a genotype. If you pick a complex phenotype, you will get nothing. It will be this series of overlapping distributions of genes that are really confusing.
Well, now, I think we are getting at a point, like for instance, Eric Lander, like one of the things he's doing, given the power of the human genome, and I guess they have sequencer free so they can just keep on sequencing stuff, that they are sequencing genomes of centenarians. And the goal is to sort of like do like maybe like brute force sequencing of genomes, and then be able to find things that genetics, like classical genetics, wasn't able to find with the association, because
that's another question for this group to really launch, and I'll tell you why, because it's something I've been trying to think about. So you're going to have a small number when you sequence genomes. Mm-hmm. Let's say if you get lucky with high volume, you could sequence 10, 20 centenarians.
Yeah.
And there's 4.5 million single nucleotide polymorphisms mm-hmm. per genome, mm-hmm. right? So how do you get rid of coincidences when you're dividing by 4.5 million possibilities into 10 genomes, right? You'll certainly get some gene in there that's right, mm-hmm. but you'll get 1,000 genes that are coincidences.
Yes, but see, if you're very dumb, you would say, okay, 4.5 million SNPs, right, means one in every 1,000 bases. So if they're really randomly distributed, if you take two individuals, the probability that you get two SNPs in the same location is one in a million, right? So that goes roughly on the order of the number of SNPs you have, so you expect one by chance in the whole genome for a pair of individuals. But if you go to 10, then maybe, there's some reason to believe that you're not completely dead.
Right.
This is sort of really back of the envelope.
Yeah, but this is hoping that leads the SNP, that is the SNP, right? If there are different SNPs, that might help you, then you're in trouble.
You made a biological assumption, which almost surely can't be correct, that there's a single place in the genome which determines everyone to live to 100 years.
If we're lucky,
if you see seven guys...
You're saying there's no haplotypes, but haplotypes dominate genetics, right? You're saying hypothetically there were no haplotypes, right?
I made a faux pas.
I think it's an interesting question. It's an interesting question.
It's laid on the table, but that's also good.
Yeah.
It relates to one of the things you had. What is the significance of the fact that you said there's a grouping in chromosome 4 and 16?
Well, that's a map of function.
If you're looking for...
So those...
get away from the problem that he doesn't think exists. Actually, you do genetics. You map. You look for linkage.
We look for a sort of like region of the chromosome that's associated with extreme looking.
But we're assuming that they're smart. They're not gonna sequence, 10 people from the same family, right? If you do that, you get 10 times the same genome, and you just completely waste.
No. Except that the one person was not a centenarian in that group of 15 children, whoever. So if you pick your people correctly. You have to know how.
Yeah, but that person smokes, right?
So I think it's going to be solved. I mean, this is not an unsolvable problem. It seems a little bit unsolvable because we don't have enough numbers. But it's just like reaching the numbers. Mm-hmm. And I think if we can reach the number of...
I asked this question to Prosser, who really cares about this, collected people, started a biotech company over that paper. did a whole bunch of things. Why on earth you wouldn't choose the SNPs in the insulin-like growth factor pathway and ask the question,
yes.
Are they correlated
yes.
with it?
Well, that's the thing we want to do yeah. with Luca in terms of with these
the
Chinese.
Of,
yeah.
of about 15 years of good genetics yeah. And make a few assumptions yeah. and go, this yeah. is crazy. Yeah.
Well, I think at the time that they were doing the studies, there was this assumption that, oh yeah, the insulin pathway was important for worms, but it wouldn't, because this was back, this was before 2003, and it's in 2003 that really it opened people's eyes that, oh wow, maybe it could also work in mammals. And I mean,
ever since Mendel, we believed that what was yeah. true of E. coli was true of the alpha.
Yeah. There was a lot of resistance, though, in the aging field into like thinking that what was true for the worm would concern.
Like sorry, interrupted.
Yeah, no, so basically what do we know from all those studies is that there is a critical pathway, the insulin signaling pathway, that seems to be playing a conserved role across evolution, at least from yeast, worms, flies, and mice. It's not really known yet in humans, but seems to be playing a conserved role in evolution to control the rate of aging. And it, when it's mutated, that the animal is long-lived. So the question now is, what is downstream of these signaling pathways, and how does it connect these signals emanating from insulin or IGF-1 to changes in gene expression or cellular function that can then impact the more long-term function of longevity and the homeostasis of the animal. And the cues into what could be the downstream targets of the insulin signaling pathways came from two facts. One was that it was shown by the group of Brian Hemmings that both AKT and the related protein kinase AsGK can translocate themselves into the nucleus in response to insulin or IGF-1, raising the possibility that those kinases could wind up regulating nuclear functions and possibly gene expression. And the second cues in terms of what type of gene regulation or what type of transcription factors this family may control came from genetic studies, again in the worm C. elegans, again by the group of Cynthia Kenyon and Gary Rifkin, who identified that by doing a suppressor screen that the PI3 kinase AKT insulin signaling pathway genetically suppressed the function of a forked transcription factor termed DAF16, and that the presence of DAF16 was critical for the extended longevity of the insulin mutants. So what about the forked family in humans? So the forked family in mammals is a huge family of transcription factors that contains probably more than 50 members. There are a lot of isoforms, so it's hard to know exactly how many. Let's say between 50 and 100 members. And they are classified in 17 subgroups, FOXA to FOXQ. And the forked transcription factors that are the most homologous to DAF16 in the worms are the FOXO family in human. And they are called FOXO1, FOXO3, and FOXO4. And now there is a new one called FOXO6. So FOXO1, 3, and 4 were identified completely independently because of their presence at chromosomal translocation in human tumors. Rhabdomyosarcomas, so tumors of the striatal muscles, for FOXO1, and acute myeloid leukemias for FOXO3 and FOXO4. So when I was a postdoc, I became interested in this family of transcription factors, their regulation, and their role in cells, and eventually in the organism, possibly for longevity.
So these are mutated in these tumors, or these are?
They are translocated in these tumors, and the translocation leads to a chimeric transcription factor that fuses the C-terminal portion of the FOXO transcription factors, which is a transactivation domain, to other transcription factors like PAX3 and PAX7, that's for FOXO1, and MLL, that's for FOXO3 and 4. And the DNA binding properties in those tumors comes from the other transcription factors. What FOXO is providing is a very potent transactivation domain to the chimera. So when we compare the primary sequence of DAF16 in the worm and the FOXOs in human, we found the presence of three conserved consensus motifs for the protein kinase AKT, which is the same as for the protein kinase SGK for that matter, which is R for arginine, X, any amino acid, R, XX, and then serine, which are the phospho acceptor sites. So this raised the possibility that the FOXO family of transcription factors could be direct targets of the protein kinase AKT and SGK. So to test this possibility, what we did was to generate phosphospecific antibodies, antibodies that only recognize the phosphorylated form of FOXO at each of those three sites. And using those phosphospecific antibodies in a Western blot experiment, we found that indeed AKT or the related kinase SGK induced the phosphorylation of FOXO3 in cells. And we chose FOXO3 among all the isoforms because it's expressed ubiquitously, but also because it's extremely abundant in the nervous system, and we are interested in the role of this family of factors in the nervous system as well. So you can see here that AKT and SGK phosphorylate the three sites, but with slightly different specificity, with AKT preferentially phosphorylating the first and second site of phosphorylation, whereas SGK preferentially phosphorylate the first and third phosphorylation sites of FOXO. So FOXO3 is phosphorylated by those two kinases at all those three conserved consensus sites. Now the question becomes, what is the function of this phosphorylation on FOXO3? So, yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm missing how the assay works.
So what you do is that you co-express, you transfect in cells, you introduce in cells DNA encoding an active version of AKT or DNA encoding an active version of SGK. And then you select the cells that express those active form and you check the phosphorylation. You just lyse the cells, run the lysis on the gel, do a Western blot, and because the antibodies are only directed against not the total form of FOXO, but the phosphorylated form of FOXO, this is a way to monitor, if you wish, when FOCAD is phosphorylated at this specific site.
But how do you know this directly?
We did also, I'm not presenting that, but we've published that. So to know that it's directly, we did in vitro experiment where we mixed the kinase, the purified kinase, with in the presence of p32, and we show that there is an increase in the incorporation of p32. We also use the phosphospecific antibodies in vitro. So yeah, it's direct and also within cells. This experiment doesn't show that it's direct.
Do these differences in phosphorylation patterns have functional consequences of longevity?
So it does, in a sense that not really like different target genes, but it seems that each of the sites, as on the function that I'm going to describe, each of the sites really contribute, and only one mutating only one site doesn't have the same effect as mutating two, which doesn't have the same effect as mutating three. But they all seem to be doing a similar function in terms of function on the protein, which is the localization. So when we did the, when we tried to ask the question of what is phosphorylation doing, we used immunofluorescence experiments to determine where was FOXO3 localized within cells. And we found that in the absence of growth factors, when AKT and SGK are inactive, FOXO3 is localized in the cell nucleus, like many transcription factors in contact with, possibly in contact with promoters. Now, by contrast, the expression of an active form of AKT and SGK triggers the relocalization of FOXO3 from the nucleus to the cytoplasm. So, and this is not only when you overexpress AKT and SGK, which can be considered as a sort of like a perturbation of the system, but this is in primary cultures of cerebral adrenal neurons, where you can see that in the absence of growth factor, FOXO3, which is in red, is present in the nucleus, which you can see in blue, whereas when you add growth factor, in this case IGF-1, you see the relocalization of FOXO3 from away from the nucleus into the processes, the dendrites, and the axons of the neurons. So now the question becomes, what is the functional consequence of this subcellular relocalization, this exclusion from the nucleus of FOXO3 on FOXO3 function as a transcription factor? And first of all, is FOXO an activator of transcription or a repressor of transcription? So to address this question, we use a luciferase reporter gene under the control of a cluster of three FOCAD responsive elements that we found in the promoter of the gene encoding FAST ligand. And when we use this reporter construct, we found that FOXO3, in the absence of growth factor, was an extremely potent transactivator of transcription. And what AKT and LTK do, probably by localizing forkhead out of the nucleus, is to drastically suppress the transcriptional activity of these transcription factors. So this experiment provided a molecular explanation for the genetic findings in C. elegans that the PI3 kinase AKT pathway genetically suppressed the function of these transcription factors. And they led us to the model whereby the FOXO transcription factors function in the nucleus as potent transactivators in the absence of signal, when insulin and IGF-1 are not present and when the cascade is not activated. By contrast, when insulin or IGF-1 are present, they bind to the receptor, trigger the activation of PI3 kinase AKT-SGK. As I told you, AKT and SGK can translocate into the nucleus, and in collaboration with Mike Yaffe at MIT, we were able to show that the phosphorylation of FOXO3 first occurs in within the nucleus and then leads to the binding of a chaperone protein called 1433, which is a small chaperone protein. And what we think happens is that the binding of FOXO3, the phosphorylated FOXO3 to this chaperone molecule triggers a change in conformation in the protein, which exposes nuclear export signal, and we indeed map two nuclear export signals in the sequence of FOXO3 that were important for its active nuclear export into the cytoplasm away from its nuclear target genes and preventing the transcription. So that's the model that we had for the regulation. Yeah.
So what happened to the translocated FOXO3 in the cancer tissues?
So in the cancer,
it doesn't activate.
So in the cancer tissues, it's not clear yet exactly what is clear is what the translocation is giving. What is not clear is what is sufficient or necessary to produce this event. So what happens in the cancer is that, as I was saying, it's the C-terminal part of FOXO that gets fused, because there is a chromosomal translocation, to the DNA binding domain and other regulatory function of other transcription factors.
Okay, so
in this case, exactly.
So it's
now,
still making the transactivator.
Right.
Yes. Now, mind you, the other thing that happens with this translocation is that you're losing one of the copies, the normal copies of FOXO, because this one gets destroyed in the process. So, as you are going to see, FOXO has functions that are reminding of a tumor suppressor function. So it's possible that the cancer that arises in those patients, those kids actually, result both from the translocation with other genes that are induced, that are due to the other transcription factors, as well as the loss of one copies of the FOXO. But it hasn't been proven.
Like the loss could raise the mutation rate.
Yeah.
So you showed that FOXO3 is an activator by taking an upstream sequence of a gene that you know is regulated by FOXO3.
Yes.
And putting it in front of a luciferase.
Well, that we suspected at first, like now we know it's a, but at first we suspected because it had forkhead binding sites. But it could be binding sites for other forkhead family members for that matter.
Okay, so are you pretty convinced that there is no sort of other function of FOXO3, you can bind other things and act as a repressor?
There are reports in the literature, and when we did, I'm going to go into the arrays, although I'm not going to present that, so I'm glad you asked the question. There are reports in the literature that says that FOXO, under some circumstances, can act as a repressor. So it's a very potent activator under most circumstances, but it can also act as a very potent repressor. And so far, what distinguishes it from a repressor to an activator, is it like sequences that are different in the promoters, or is it because it's binding to different type of complex? Is it because it's in a different complex, depending on the surrounding elements, is not known. But yeah, it has been reported that it can be a very potent repressor as well. So this is for the regulation, but now the question becomes, what is the function of this family of transcription factors, especially when they are in the nucleus, in contact with their target genes, and what are the target genes of these transcription factors in mammals, and can that give us some insight into the function in cells, but also maybe in the organisms? So we did a genome-wide screen for FOXO target genes in mammals using microarrays. And just to remind you that the conditions where FOXO is in the nucleus, all the conditions where insulin and IGF-1 are not present or low, or when the signaling pathway is mutated, and those are the conditions that lead to an extended or increased longevity in both worms, flies, and mice. So maybe knowing the target genes of FOXO can give us some insight into this extension of longevity. Now, in order to address the target genes, and especially the direct target genes, well, at the time of the transcription factors, we decided that what we needed was a way to, at will, put FOXO3 into the nucleus so that we can isolate the target genes that are rapidly induced by these transcription factors that are more likely to represent the direct target gene and not the targets of these transcription factors. So to generate an inducible form of FOXO3, what we did was to fuse FOXO3 with the ligand binding domain of the estrogen receptor. And this chimeric protein, as you can see when expressed in cells, is localized a little bit diffusely throughout the cells and mostly in the cytoplasm. Now, by contrast, when you add tamoxifen, which is an artificial ligand for the estrogen receptor, you trigger, by still an unknown mechanism, but probably a change in conformation, you trigger the very rapid relocalization of FOXO3 into the nucleus. And this can be as soon as 2 minutes, FOXO goes into the nucleus. And not only is that, we didn't use these properties, but it's interesting, it's also reversible, meaning that if you wash out the tamoxifen, FOXO3 goes back into the cytoplasm. So this system provided us with a way to, at will, put FOXO3 into the nucleus and then isolate the RNA that were induced rapidly, so we did time course experiments, rapidly upon FOXO3 into the nucleus and hybridizing on microarrays. So we did that back in 2001. So the arrays that we used were Millennium filter arrays containing 12,000 genes or ESTs. So this is a cDNA arrays. And we did that more recently with an Affymetrix rat arrays containing 8,000 oligos. So we identified a series of genes that were, most of the genes that we identified were induced by FOXO3, but we identified a very small fraction that was repressed. So again, to come back to your question, here I'm only putting the genes that are induced and that were annotated and had a known function, but we also found a bunch of unknown genes that we haven't studied really yet.
Do you, for the Affymetrix result or your microarray results, do you believe the results on a gene by gene basis, or are you looking at families or something like that?
So the way we do the analysis, you mean families of genes or?
I mean, you know, for instance, most people who do, one of the common things people do with microRNAs, they microarrays, they look for, you know, massive groups that are co-expressed.
Yeah.
When you filter out the noise.
Yeah, so that's what we did for, actually we did that more for the Millennium arrays, because that's the one we published. This was to redo, to verify that we didn't have like a specific array thing. But we clustered the genes, like basically we had 3 major clusters, the genes that were induced very rapidly, and the genes that were induced a little bit more slowly, but still like compatible with it being direct. And then another series of genes that was sort of like induced and then stayed on for a long period of time.
But I mean, do you believe that
we verified the one that I put here are also verified by other methods, independent methods, by Western blot, Northern blot, real time PCR, and chromatin IP. So
how well does this work? How well? I mean,
Millennium array are excellent.
So
everything you saw on the array was real, and we took, mind you, we took a cutoff that was considered low. We took a cutoff of 2. Plus the cluster analysis, but still, like a 2-fold is generally sort of like frowned upon by people who do arrays by saying, "Oh, that's kind of low." But every single thing that we found, but this is a filter array, so it's very similar to a Northern blot in a way. So it's like gigantic. This was the sort of like ancestor of the arrays. Yet they put a lot of genes, 12,000 genes in it, so it was nice. But with the Affymetrix, you can see that it's funny, like the genes that came up with a fold factor of like 2.5, like GAT45 for instance, 2.5 induction on the Millennium arrays and been verified and it's great. It's 18-fold induction average on the Affymetrix arrays. So you can see differences in terms of the induction there. So I think it's more sensitive and probably more prone to error, so you have to be more careful with a cheap arrays than a filter arrays, which is more like an organ. Yeah.
How do you exactly distinguish genes which are directly, which are direct targets from genes which might not be direct targets? How exactly do you set hash coding times?
So we did 30 minutes, an hour, 3 hours, 5 hours, 8 hours. So the hour, I mean, the sort of like kinetics doesn't, I mean, it's still possible, although hard to imagine, but it's still possible that let's say 1 hour may be enough to already make the RNA, the protein of a transcription factor, this protein go into the nucleus, bind another set of target genes and induce them, and you have another RNA. So it could still possibly be indirect. What we were thinking of doing, but we didn't do it, was to block, to do the same experiment, but by blocking, for instance, translation with cyclohexamine, because then you would be sure that whatever you get is just direct target and not target of targets, because the translation would be blocked. But the problem with cyclohexamine to block translation is that it also has non-specific effects, but it affects signal transduction cascade like P38 or junk kinase, which you'll see later feed also into forkheads. So we didn't do it because we thought it was going to be more dirty in the end. Now, in order to show, to determine whether those are direct or not, we did chromatin immunoprecipitation on the promoter, like identify the potential binding site. We didn't do the chromatin IP actually on all of those targets, but we did it on GAT45, P27, cyclin G2, MNSOD, and BIM, and pus ligand. So those are direct targets.
Just from my variegated, did you like see two very different groups of genes, like one which are activated early and then the other one which is late?
A little bit, like what I was saying with the clustered, but it wasn't as if we could say, oh look, like there are those like direct target genes and then there are the targets of targets. It wasn't like that. The cluster were very overlapping, and it was hard to tell whether they were just because some genes are induced rapidly by forkhead and some genes are induced more slowly, or whether some of them are direct and some of them are indirect. I think what would answer your question would be some kind of cleave experiments with an inhibitor of translation type of, but just hard to do, like, because the inhibitors that we have are not that.
Okay, in the end, verify the comment immunity.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a minor comment. I mean, we sort of played similar games in yeast and trying to sequence and macroarray ML together. And the experience is that this expectation that there is a transcription factor cascade is the only way to get second-hand hits is not quite right. I mean, what happens sometimes is that you upregulate or downregulate something in a signal transduction cascade, and the baseline activity of a transcription factor on the bottom of it goes up or down.
Yeah.
Right? So it can happen in all kinds of ways. Yeah. Looking for transcription factors is not the only way.
Yeah.
But your idea of sort of blocking translation, if it works, is a nice one.
Mm-hmm.
Then you just get transcripts and nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's an apparently clean one, but in...
Yeah, but it makes sense of everything else.
If you just put cyclohexamine into cells, you change transcription rates from that to many genes.
Yeah.
So what does that mean?
Yeah.
You're not just blocking translation. Yeah. You can imagine a short-lived repressor, key repressor now. You can imagine a lot of things.
Yeah.
And you do see big changes.
Yeah.
So it's
even used for that.
Right.
Yeah. People use it to do like what they call like super induction of the RNA. You see like more RNA even. So it's very, tough.
How many genes may there?
So there wasn't as much as we were expecting. But again, like now after the talk yesterday, I don't want to expect anything. They were, of the gene that made the cutoff, I don't remember the exact number, but about 100, less than 100. Yeah. So not that many. And then about the gene that made the cutoff for repression was very low, like probably like less than 20.
If you ask the question about repression now, right, are there any genes which are de-repressed when you turn it on? To say these are genes which are turned off or turned on as you move FOX around the nucleus.
Yeah.
How do they fall into those two groups?
De-repressed, so like if we were to put like genes that were repressed by FOXO and then that are de-repressed.
Yeah, you had some oxygen and FOXO moves out of the nucleus, right?
No, it moves in. Yeah. So then we would see the repressed one.
The other way.
Yeah, that would be good. We haven't done it yet. We haven't done the wash away and the, right. the yeah, that would be mixed. We haven't done that yet.
Just another question for you, probably this, but do you do control where you just move the ligand domain of ER?
So what we did as a control were several fold, and they, I'm not putting them here, but they entered in our analysis of the array. One of them was just to have cells that don't express that, that were treated by tamoxifen, because it could be that tamoxifen by itself. Although there is no receptor for tamoxifen in the cells we used, but no endogenous, but still tamoxifen has its effect.
Yeah,
so that's one.
I'm worried about it.
And two, we did a control where we had the FOXO3 ER, but with a deletion. In the DNA binding domain of FOXO3. So it has the ER, but it doesn't have the DNA binding domain. Now, apparently, when I interviewed at UCSF, like there was a guy there who, and I don't remember his name, he's very famous, he's identified the growth hormone, I think, receptor, or like, no, the glucocorticoid receptor. And he was telling me that this is not the best control because the ER can have an effect. But in general, this effect is when it's brought up to DNA, close to DNA. So the fact that we've made a mutant, and there is still the open possibility, like if you want to really be critical about those experiments, that if we were, a better control would be to have another Fox family member, which is also hooked up with ER and really brings ER to the DNA. Because not bringing it to the DNA is not going to control. So basically, to sort of like, we were aware of this caveat. So what we did was to try to then repeat some of the experiments without the ER, where we just had a mutant of FOXO3 that was nuclear, without all the ER thing, and then see whether the gene was induced. And all the genes that I present here have been verified by this independent approach. Yeah. But still, it's an important control, I think, for everyone who uses the ER system.
I forgot what cell these are.
These are red-point fibroblasts, so it's flat fibroblasts. So what we, like the genes, the three categories of genes that we found were interesting in the sense that we found genes that were involved in cell cycle arrest at the G1S phase and also at the G2M transition. And those cell cycle checkpoints are critical for the cells to basically sense the check the integrity of their macromolecules and in particular the genetic materials, and if the genetic materials has been damaged, to repair the genetic materials before it goes the S phase or before it's given to daughter cells. And indeed, we found genes that were involved, although it's been sort of like controversial now for GET45, but that are involved in the repair of damaged DNA. And that are also involved in the detoxification from the reactive oxygen species, which are the toxic byproduct of stress and that are the damaging byproduct of oxidative stress stimulation, like manganese superoxide dismutase. But then we also found another category of genes that are the genes that are involved in cell death. So the first category of genes was interesting to us because it can be summarized as what you can call resistance in a way to oxidative stress, where the cell slows down or stops and repairs and detoxifies. But then on the other hand, you have cell death. So we wanted to verify if indeed not only was FOXO inducing those programs, but whether this was resulting in the actual function on the cells of that. So
it's like there's a substrate for cyclin G2 is a subunit of a PP2A phosphatase. Is the substrate known? Is the substrate for that known?
For PP2A?
No, PP2A is the phosphatase. Cyclin G2 should give it specificity.
I see. No, I didn't know that.
Cyclin G1, which is a very close relative, P53 regulated gene, it combines with PP2A, and its substrate is NDM2. So cyclin G2,
that's
I know, is a subunit of the PP2A phosphatase, which gives it specificity.
Oh, that's interesting, because, I mean, one...
Undoubtedly a cell cycle regulator like
P27. Yeah.
But, you know...
I don't know. It's possible that it's known, and I don't know.
There's a whole family. There's a G1, G2, G3. Mm-hmm. They're all related. They're all interesting because they look like cyclins.
So they've been implicated in the G2M transition, or am I wrong to assume that?
I don't know.
both G1 and
EG2. So it's interesting, you can see right away that some of those target genes are also target genes, and there is another one that I haven't put here, WEEP1, are also target genes of PT3. So some target genes of like GAT45, K26 are target genes of PT3, and WEEP1 that we found is also a target gene of PT3. So they are shared, and when we did the asymmetrics, we also found under some circumstances that P21
GAT25 fast ligand, which ones? WEEP1 and which was the other?
PA26. Yeah. So they are common target between PTG3 and FOX protein factors. So now the question is, like, are those genes really resulting in a function? So to do that, we use another mutant, which is the mutant that can no longer be phosphorylated by AKTR and HTK because all three phosphorylation sites have been replaced by an alanine. And this mutant, even in the presence of growth factor, is localized in the nucleus, whereas the wild type is cytoplasmic. And when we transfected this mutant into cells, we observed a very strong arrest in the G1 phase of the cell cycle and a prevention of the entry into SLA. So indeed, we have a G1 arrest. We also showed, I'm not presenting that here, that we had a G2, not arrest, but a G2 pose in the cell cycle. So indeed, FOXO is inducing, at least the mutated form of FOXO is inducing cell cycle arrest. We use real-time PCR to determine if you introduce a damaged DNA template into cells, whether FOXO, the presence of FOXO in the nucleus, would be indeed able to induce the repair of damaged DNA. And we found that the nuclear mutant of FOXO increases the repairability of this damaged DNA, whereas a mutant that can no longer bind to DNA cannot do that, indicating that it's due to the binding of FOXO to target genes. And finally, we wanted to see whether it could also induce cell death. So this time we turned towards the cerebellar granule neurons, which are good cellular models for cell survival and cell death, and we expressed this mutant into those neurons. And what we found is that when FOXO3, the nuclear form, is expressed into cerebellar granule neurons, it induces apoptosis as measured by condensation of fragmentation of the chromatin and fragmentation of the processes. And this is quantified here, and this is dependent, again, on, well, this time on the transactivation domain, because the mutant that's deleted in the transactivation domain of FOXO3 can no longer induce apoptosis. So here we go. We have one transcription factor, or it's a family of transcription factor, the FOXO, that can induce a series of genes and cellular functions that are very diverse, that can range from cell cycle arrest, DNA repair, detoxification of reactive oxygen species, and those were interesting because they constitute stress resistance. And as I said in the beginning, stress resistance is highly correlated with increased longevity and at least could be part of the mechanisms by which FOXO, when present in the nucleus, could confer this extended longevity. But we also found the function of FOXO as being inducing cell death, which to a limited extent is also probably beneficial for organismal longevity, even though it seems a little bit counterintuitive. And it is in the sense that, for instance, cell death is responsible for eliminated cells that are terminally damaged or cells that are mutant, like, for instance, cancer cells at the beginning, and as such can be for the organism something positive and could contribute to longevity. But you can see right away that an excess of cell death has probably very negative function and results in the death of the animals. So now the question becomes, how can a single transcription factors induce such a wide variety of target genes and cellular functions and even antagonistic functions, stress resistance on the one hand and cell death on the other hand? So at this stage, we made the hypothesis that maybe FOXO was integrated more extracellular conditions than just insulin and IGF-1. And perhaps it was integrating stress stimulation, and maybe at low levels of stress stimuli, it would induce stress resistance. But at high level of stress stimuli that are very damaging for the cells, it would induce cell death. So now,
So what is your estimate for how many direct targets are of this FOXO?
So, all in all, as I said, the one we found on our array, but the array that we did is 12,000 plus 8,000, some of them are overlapping, so it's not the whole genome by any means. And it was less than 100, about 100 that were upregulated that we found. Now, so people have done other ones, and we all find the same type of targets, and the one that come up first are similar. Now, there were genes that were that are still unknown, so for which the function is unknown. But again, it would be nice to now redo it, and I don't think people have done that yet on like the whole sort of like whole genome array type of thing. I mean, my words.
Does the cell-dead targets do they depend upon how strong the or about the local level of FOXO or something, or it's really another post-translation in one file form?
So there are several, we don't know yet, and we are testing several hypotheses at the moment. So you can see it can come from several things. It can come from cell type specificity. It's possible that in neurons they are more prone to cell death. So we didn't do all the assay in the same cells. So it could be the cells, it could be that it's not modified the same way. It could be that it could be sort of like the amount, like when you activate it, the more you activate it, then you reach cell death. Or it could just be that, or hypothesis, and I'll come back to that at the end, is that there is a molecular code that's encoded by phosphorylation, acetylation, and probably other post-transitional modification on FOXO itself that helps it decide to go to which target genes. But that's our working hypothesis. So this regulation by extracellular conditions brings me to the environmental control of longevity. So in the first part of my talk, I showed you that longevity has a strong genetic basis and that the genes encoding the insulin receptor cascade are very important to control longevity. But there are also very important factors in the environment that affect tremendously, impact tremendously lifespan. And here I just put the positive effects, although they are not so easy to do, but still, they impact lifespan in a positive manner in that they extend it. You can find zillion factors that obviously affect lifespan by reducing it. Both of them are toxic or like adverse reagents. But basically, reduction in caloric intake, the 40% reduction, it's a very drastic reduction in caloric intake, can increase very, very significantly longevity in a wide range of species. It's been tested in worms, in spiders, in flies, in birds, in mouse, in rat, in baboon, in macaque, and it's probably the case that in human as well. There are circumstantial evidence that humans that have been caloric restricted, that doesn't mean undernourished, right? It means like it's just caloric restriction, but your level of vitamins and minerals is still the same, right? Now, another way to increase longevity is chronic low levels of oxidative stress. This is called hormesis. It hasn't been shown to work yet in mammals, but it's very striking that if you expose a worm or a fly to low levels of some oxidative stress or some stress, like for instance some heat shock, but not killing heat shock, just like a little bit of heat shock, the worms or the flies will live longer. So it's, and the mechanism of this hormesis effect is not known. It's maybe because like it's the what doesn't kill you make you stronger type of things. Maybe it already prones, raises the stress response and primes the animal when bigger stress comes about, but it's not known. And finally, and this one is more fun, there are some circumstantial evidence that components that are very enriched in red wine, called, and this component, one of these components is called resveratrol, it's a polyphenol, can have an effect to increase longevity, at least in worms, in flies, and in yeast. And in human, there are evidence that drinking red wine, not too much, but drinking a little bit of red wine is positive for some age-dependent diseases, like, for instance, neurodegenerative disease, prevents them. Yeah?
Where is the immune system?
Sorry?
Where is the immune system? I mean, you would think that there's something that would also direct targets you were showing,
so
any obvious links or
so in terms of FOXO or in terms of environmental control of lifespan?
Both. Okay. You would think that
it's very important, and some people think. I mean, there are a lot of people that are now thinking that a lot of what extreme longevity is maybe having a very potent immune system, which then defeats cancer because like the tumor cells are being suppressed or killed right away, and that can defeat also other mechanisms. And it's interesting to note that usually what centenarians die from, and they have to die from something, right? They don't die of cancer, they don't die of neurodegenerative disease, they tend to die of pneumonia, which is, I mean, sort of like a rapid failure, a sort of like brutal failure of the immune system. And it's as if the centenarians had a good immune system for a long period of time, and then at the very end of their life, like, the immune system just like goes bad and they become susceptible to infections that they weren't susceptible to, which is also the case in worms. Like, the worms wind up dying of E. coli that they eat normally, E. coli infection. So they would, and obviously they don't have T cells and B cells, but they still have innate immunity. And there is a possibility that's very that is real, and Cynthia probably talked about that, that the sort of like innate immune system can contribute to the longevity. So this argues that maybe there is, and I'll come back to that at the end, of maybe there is some kind of like a non-cell autonomous or like a sort of like more organismal general control of longevity to which the immune system is an important part, and it's controlling the whole body surveillance, if you wish. Now, for FOXO now, in the immune system, it's very abundantly expressed in the immune system, and it's not by chance, I think, that it's sort of like in the translocation, like the FOXO3 and FOXO4 are found in human chromosomal translocation that lead to acute myeloid leukemias. It's for two reasons. First, because obviously it gets fused to MLL, which is a famous gene that is involved in leukemia or in blood cells, but also because the levels of expression of FOXO3 in B cells and T cells is very abundant, and same thing for FOXO4. Now, the function of FOXO in those cells is very similar to what I've shown for the other ones. It seems to induce apoptosis under some circumstances, but maybe prevention of proliferation of those cells at the beginning. So it's not clear yet what the direct effect of on immunity is. And the mouse models are just at the beginning, so we don't
need to. Two things to say about that, I think, that are really useful. One is that, because myeloid cells are not immune cells, they actually become monocytes and neutrophils, both of which actually use oxidative bursts to kill bacteria and other cells.
It's like innate immunity.
That's right. Having ROS, anti-ROS activity is very good to protect them under the conditions where they're actually generating oxidative bursts to kill. So that's why the myeloid, the acute myeloid leukemias, that's why they have such high toxic levels, I think. But the immune system is actually probably great. There are four or maybe five stress response systems in the cell. And the stress response system to inflammation is an NF-kappa B system, which in fact is very integrated with these other three stress responses like FOXO and P53 and others. So there's a lot of crosstalk between NF-kappa B and these transcription factors, and there may even be, as you just saw, there were five genes regulated by P53 and FOXO. There may be an interesting overlapping set of genes regulated by NF-kappa B, but predominantly with stress responses and immune system or NF-kappa B responses.
Well, there is a recent report that says that IKK can directly phosphorylate 4K. So at this level, there is also a crossover between the IKK, IKB, and NF-kappa B pathway, and the FOXO transcription pathway.
It might be interesting to do the direct target experiment in say,
T cells. Yeah. I don't know if they've done that. So in the B cells, in T cells, that's the group of Paul Copper who's shown that. It seems that the main target genes for FOXO3 is BIM. And this is a pro-apoptotic. And it's a pro-apoptotic BCL2 family member. So in that case, well, again, like it's overexpression studies, so it's always a little bit hard to know what endogenicity is doing, and it's the way it's mouse model to do that. But overexpressing FOXO in the T cells induces apoptosis, and it's mediated mostly by BIM. All right, so now the question becomes, how can we connect the environmental control of lifespan to the genetic control of lifespan, and how are those ways to control longevity integrated at the molecular level? Well, the group of Lenny Guaranty and of David Sinclair have indicated that there is one critical molecule that can integrate actually all those three conditions, calorie restriction, chronic low levels of oxidative stress, and resveratrol, which has been found to bind directly to SIRT2, and to induce longevity. And again, it's not known in mammals yet, but at least in yeast, C. elegans and Drosophila. So I don't know if Cynthia introduced you with SIRT2 yet. What is SIRT2? So SIRT2 is a D-acetylase that is dependent on LAD plus to function. And it integrates environmental cues, perhaps it's still controversial, to the NAD levels, like the ratio of NAD and NADH. And as a deacetylase, it can deacetylate histones, but it's also been found by the group of Wei Gu and the group of Bob Weinberg to deacetylate the transcription factor 53, Thomas Presser, well, loved here. And the question that we ask, well, now, can SIRT2 deacetylate also FOXO? And are FOXO acetylated to begin with, acetylated molecule? We know that they are phosphorylated, but are they also acetylated and deacetylated? So using acetyl-specific antibodies in Western blood experiments, we found that FOXO3 indeed is can be acetylated in vitro by PCAF or P300, but also in its acetylated in cells. And those are direct in vitro experiments. When we incubate SIRT2, purified SIRT2, with acetylated FOXO3, only in the presence of NAD can you see that SIRT2 directly deacetylates this transcription factor in a test tube. Now, what happens in vivo, so we used cells from SIRT2-minus mice that have been generated by the group of Fred Alt at Children's Hospital, and what we found is that the levels of acetylated FOXO3 increase when SIRT2 is mutated in the mice, which indicate that normally SIRT2 functions to deacetylate FOXO3, and when SIRT2 is not present anymore, the level of FOXO3 acetylation increases. We've also found that SIRT2 can bind to FOXO, so SIRT2, this deacetylase, which is important for longevity, binds to and deacetylates FOXO3. Now the question is, what's the consequence on the function? So what we tested two functions of FOXO3, stress resistance, well in this case it was more like the cell cycle arrest, G1 arrest, and we found that FOXO3, the induction of FOXO3 induces G1 arrest, as we've seen before, as measured by BRDU incorporation, and the presence of extra copies of SIRT2 potentiates the ability of FOXO3 to induce cell cycle arrest. Now, if we do the same thing, but this time in neuronal apoptosis, because FOXO3 also induces apoptosis, we found that this time extra copies of SIRT2 don't potentiate, but on the contrary, inhibit, doesn't completely suppress it, but significantly diminishes the ability of FOXO3 to induce neuronal cell death. So here, our working models becomes that SIRT2, by deacetylating FOXO3, tip the balance of FOXO function. So FOXO has this antagonistic function, as I was saying. Apoptosis, cell death on the one hand, and stress resistance, which is associated with longevity on the other hand. And what SIRT2 does, maybe, is to integrate extracellular conditions to tip the balance of FOXO away from apoptosis towards stress resistance. And this may be a way by which SIRT2 could increase longevity is via the deacetylation of FOXO3. Now, yeah.
So there are two possibilities for what the function of acetylation could be on the transcription factor. One is it could change the activity on all genes. Mm-hmm. And the other is it could change the pattern of transcription genes. So you might predict right away by going back to your just look at the pro-apoptotic functions and ask whether in the presence of SIRT2, higher levels of SIRT2, you actually get a reduced amount of FAST made. That would change the pattern of transcription.
Yes, so that's our model, except that it's I think we need to do like a more. So our So the question is, well, how can it do that? And are we like, how can the same molecule, which is a deacetylase, deacetylate FOXO, and have differential effect? You would think that if FOXO is deacetylated, it's deacetylated, and therefore it's going to have the same function on the apoptosis targeting and the stress resistance targeting. So it was puzzling to us at first. So our hypothesis, and maybe I can say like what Bill did to that, is that in fact deacetylation, it's a simple word because in fact it's not just deacetylation of one site. It turns out when we did tandem mass spectrometry experiment to identify what were the modification of FOXO3 that were induced in response to oxidative stress, we found 5 acetylation sites, and we found 8 novel phosphorylation sites that are different from the AKT-SGK site that I talked to you about. So FOXO is a heavily modified phosphorylated and acetylated molecule, and to come back to your question here, our working model is that those modifications represent a molecular code that allows the selection of the target gene recruitment by this transcription factor, and that maybe when FOXO is heavily acetylated and phosphorylated, it's recruited specifically at promoters that induce cell death, but in response to environmental stimuli, maybe stress stimuli, when SIRT2 is present, gets activated, this triggers the deacetylation of some of the sites, maybe not all, but some of them, and this somehow induces the recruitment, the sort of like fall off of FOXO3 from the cell death promoter, and the recruitment of FOXO3 to other types of its promoter, the stress resistance type of promoter. So we are currently testing these models with a combination of chip on the chip and microarrays to see the expression.
If you put DNA affinity directly, does it show any effect at all? If you can anywhere
in EMSA? In EMSA, you mean?
Something like that, more.
We haven't tried with EMSA because we were always concerned that this may not be something that's completely that's direct, in the sense that it needed to have the chromatin environment, or at least like a larger environment to do that. But so it could be
exactly where the T2 field is, because you have the same modifications on the T3s here. So if you don't mind, I'll just mention, because they bear tremendously on experimental approaches you'll take. So what you said is exactly what's the assumption, that since the DNA binding sites are in fact degenerate, and since the acetylations are on the amino groups, epsilon amino groups of lysine, they make a big impact on DNA binding, and therefore target choices. So several experiments have been done. One is to knock out all of the lysines. There's 7 lysines in B53, there are 5 here.
Mm-hmm. Probably more.
Yeah, 4, yeah.
That 5 that we found.
Each of them have been changed to arginine. And in the nicest experiment Jeff Wall did, he knocked it back into a mouse. So you're really looking at a mouse that didn't have B53 with a knock-in of 7 arginines for those lysines. The mouse is perfectly normal. So these acetyl groups are not essential for activating P53 for stress, but they are essential for target choice.
Yeah.
And the same thing is true with phosphorylation. There are drugs now that activate P53, ones that block P53 and neo2 interactions. And those drugs don't result in phosphorylations of P53 at the amino terminus. You get perfectly normal responses with those drugs, but again, choices of targets are. So your hypothesis is right on where the P53 field is struggling now the same way. I think these are general. I think this is going to be important generalizations, these modifications about target choice.
So based on different targets.
Yes.
As opposed to a secondary effect of recruitment of the other machinery.
Yes.
Yeah, so maybe the chip, for
there
example.
In the extreme, in the limit, there could be combinations of this. There were kind of 2 choices.
Right.
One was phosphorylation and acetylation are essential for activity. Right, so you knock it out and you, right. But that didn't seem to be the case. Mm-hmm. And the second is protein modifications, and they're combinatorics. Because you have the exact same thing. You have all these different protein kinases giving different combinatorics, and maybe even different histone-acetylases giving different combinatorics.
Yes, yes.
All these combinatorics ultimately result in choice of targets.
Mm-hmm.
But none of this said that has to be on the DNA binding specificity. It might very well be that it's on the interaction with cofactors, right?
Absolutely correct. In fact, again in P53, there are 3 proteins, ASSP1, 2, and 3, which are important for choice of targets, and they are regulated by the protein modifications. But there's also DNA binding effects. If you use acetylated transcription factor, you get weaker binding. If you use non-acetylated, so you're changing binding constants, which is exactly what you expect, because the amino terminus, well, in this case, the lysine groups, and these are the DNA binding.
Yeah, they are. A lot of them are. So this is the DNA binding domain.
So those lysines, those amino epsilon amino glycines, amino groups in lysine, are probably playing a role in contacts with
the molecule. The consensus might be slightly different.
The
consensus
is the same. Or, well, it would be interesting to do the bioinformatics, which we haven't done, but on the cell there.
Yeah, but you take the set of genes
exactly
and look at the upstream region and see modifications of.
So this is the back to this thing that no one likes, but the weighted matrix. Right. There is the consensus is just that, a consensus.
Yeah.
Right. And it has variations around the mean of the consensus of the optimum. And then you could ask that question that you're trying to ask, is there a preference?
Right.
I think the real complication, though, is the one that just got brought up, and that is that just modifications alone may not be the only thing that's driving this. Well, in the end, the size of the protein complexes associated with these transcription factors are enormous.
Yeah. We calculated it for 4K, it's 700 kilodalton, but it can go up to, probably 1,600.
So it's 10 to 15 proteins that are on the
DNA. And it could be that the complexes are different.
If you have a reasonably small laundry list of proteins with motifs, then one might try to look, but I do think that Nicholas and friends say, by looking at the combinatorials.
Well, I think what's neat about this conversation is we're getting close to starting to at least have some variables in hand that allow in informatics what you just said, which is allow an informatics search of what genes turn on and off under the varying conditions that you can put on these.
Well, yeah, I mean, even if it's DNA binding, there are sort of different possibilities. One is that this sort of changes the effective concentration.
Right, or it
targets fall into different groups.
But if you have a reasonable number of examples of binding sites in those genes and in those genes, that's pretty straightforward to answer.
Yeah. Well, I would love if someone, I don't have the, I guess I could spend some years of my life trying to learn that, but I would love if someone would be interested in that aspects of things and whom I can collaborate with.
Since you have the list, it's literally trivial.
With experimental perhaps another thing is the one thing who selects under one conditions and the other conditions.
And separate the
variables. Yeah. So and that has led so the select is in vitro basically. And in the P53 field again there are examples to which you can be led to this probably would be a good first pass. But it's possible that the bioinformatics on what's already known to be real in the cells may allow you to bypass some artifacts that have been shown to be the case in at least for P53, for 4K, I don't know what could be.
In two places where you have a chance to manipulate things really well, which is Celex, as we just heard, and one of them is yeast. There's nothing wrong with putting these proteins in yeast and a DNA sequence in yeast, and then looking at modifiers and adding things in.
Yeah.
Where that's been done, it disagrees with, for P53, it disagrees with Celex.
So the complication with forkhead, I don't know how you would bypass the fact that there is those forkhead in yeast.
Right.
That FKH1 and FKH2, which seem to be so conserved in a way that they have functions that can be even similar in terms of the cell cycle.
There are deletions, but there are two of them.
Yeah.
You might take the deletion set, unless it's
there are many ways to approach this problem.
If it is a combinatorial thing, I guess, then yeast isn't fully telling you everything.
You could actually test the subset of things you want to test. You put in
the
sequences, one different test genes,
and
then go from there.
So the one thing we wanted to do, and maybe it's going to take us a while, but it's to use the power that we have with the phospho and acetyl-specific antibodies and use those in chromatin IP. Instead of chromatin IPing with the total antibody, you just chromatin IP. That may not work because if the site is right where the DNA binds, it may not be recognized and blah, blah, blah. There may be some problems with that. But if you were able to immunoprecipitate specifically with the phospho-specific antibody and the acetyl-specific antibody, then you chipen the chip so that you have a snapshot, basically, of what modification is associated with what promoter. And because I'm going to present some of the evidence that all the modifications, as you were saying, are combinatorial, then you would have this molecular code. You would associate a combination of modification with a subset of target genes.
Right. But another possibility, of course, is that what differentiates between the different targets is the histone structure at the DNA of those targets, so you would not be able to see it from sequence at all.
Right. You mean like the bioinformatics?
Yeah,
I think if you don't have,
that acetylation state and phosphorylation state of FOXO3 be determinate, right? Because that should be fairly independent of the chromatin.
Well, that's something I want to ask you. Durante seen this SIR2 was actually as an HDAC was affecting DNA. I mean, not that he was saying it didn't affect
histones.
Chromatin.
In yeast, it's definitely affecting histones. So, in mammals, and in yeast, it has a very strong effect that's very simple. It shuts off everything almost. So, but it seems to be the case that in mammals, we didn't generate actually with SIR2. And at first we were thinking, oh yeah, well, I'm just going to see. And it's just like all over the place. You have genes that get up, you have that are upregulated, downregulated. You have so many clusters. It's really hard to know, probably because it has so many also like target factor, so it doesn't seem to be a strong repressor like it is in mammals.
One of these names on the way blue paper that says when it takes off a substitution P53, it's pretty clear that this is not only a histone acetylase, it's a protein, deacetylase, it's an MHC-dependent protein deacetylase, not only a histone.
Yeah.
But it's both, or was that
just
wrong?
It's probably both.
Wrong. It's a subset of what its activities are in histones. Like a both, better to call it a protein deacetylase than a histone deacetylase.
Yeah. Like a FDAC, it's called like a factor deacetylase rather than an HDAC. I mean, it's possibly, probably both an HDAC and an FDAC at this stage. Hot one.
I mean, it's actually, this is becoming a great generalization for methylation as well. I mean, everything that's done to histones is done to transcription factors, which sit right on the nucleus.
But that means that if it's really an HDAC, it could be changing your what's available for
And it could be that FOXO is.
It's a coordinate regulation of the transcription factor in histones.
So you can also imagine a model where what FOXO is doing, what those sites are doing, is to recruit SIR2. And once SIR2 is recruited, depending on how much is recruited and depending on how it's recruited, then it's acting on the histone. But if it was just doing that, I have trouble understanding how it could increase some genes. Because it does increase direct target genes of FOXO, like P27. Now, it may do it in an indirect manner, but the fact that it increases the G1 arrest, and we know, I didn't present that, but we know it increases P27, and you sort of like have a hard time rationalizing how, if it were a histone deacetylase, it could increase. I mean, it's still possible, but how could it increase gene expression?
But it's, because the deacetylase FOXO, for some reason, makes it a better...
No, on the transcription factor, you understand it. It could. But on just the histone, if it was just the fact that SIR2 was growth and then acting to modify just the chromatin, it would be hard to understand how it would do that positively on some genes, how it would activate some genes and impress some genes. I think to understand... at least to me, to rationalize the fact that it's inducing some genes and repressing others.
Wasn't there some results, I don't know if that's even true or if you can believe it, but were there some results that some fork proteins actually look sort of like closed chromatin? There was this...
Oh, yes. So he was saying that I've seen a map track on that, that it looks like a histone,
Sort of more like heterochrome.
Yes.
And open it up, maybe I could prefer it.
That's possible. He's the only, I've seen the abstract,
I don't know.
Could be. So,
he comes from Philadelphia, you can't count on.
So basically, I'm just going to present like a little bit of like work in progress that we are doing to try to start addressing this issue. So what we did is to generate phosphospecific antibody to those new sites, and we are in the process of generating acetyl-specific antibody to all those sites. And as you can see, You already have, depending on what the stress stimuli you use, UV radiation, H2O2, stress or heat shock, you already have a slightly different pattern into which phosphorylation is induced. With UV induces all three and heat shock induces all three phosphorylation, but H2O2 seems to preferentially induce the phosphorylation of 4-13. So that, combined to the fact that stress appears to be dominant over growth factor to send back FOXO3 into the nucleus, even in the presence of growth factor, where FOXO is normally in the cytoplasm, adding stress stimuli dominates over growth factor to send back FOXO into the nucleus where it can contact target genes. Now, which target genes? This is what we're trying to sort out by chromatin IP. Well, if you stimulate with H2O2, FOXO3 can get recruited to promoters of some of its stress type of target genes, like MNSOD or cyclin G2, but it doesn't get recruited to one of its other very well characterized, actually, target genes that I didn't present here, but that was identified first by Terry Unterman, and which is a bona fide target for FOXO3, doesn't seem to be recruited. So again, that's work in progress, but that's indicated us towards a model where FOXO3 would be shut off by trophic support or insulin and IGF-1 by maintaining it into the cytoplasm. So that's complete shut off. Now, in response to oxidative stress, FOXO3 would act as an integrator, as a rheostat even, if you wish, of oxidative stress level, and maybe at low level of stress it would just go back into the nucleus and be modified in such a way that it would be recruited to those of the genes that induce cell cycle rest and DNA repair, because at low level of stress, it makes sense for the cells to rest and repair. But at high level of stress, that are very damaging for the cells, it would be modified at another combination of those sites, maybe this time acetylation, more phosphorylation, and this would induce the recruitment this time to other types of genes, the genes that are involved in apoptosis, that would then lead to the elimination of the terminally damaged target genes. Terminally damaged cells by stress stimuli. So in that model, FOXO would really integrate a wide variety of stimuli, insulin and IGF-1, on and off, but also stress stimuli as a rheostat of maybe the level, the intensity, or the type of stress stimuli.
Yeah. So one of the reasons that really interesting feedbacks here is the same feedback that happens in p53. So GLP-1 is a phosphatase that inactivates p38 MAP kinase. And the exact same, the p38 MAP kinase not only phosphorylates FOXO here, it phosphorylates p53 at two critical sites, which are very pro-apoptotic sites. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're the sites that are needed to bind the ASSP1 proteins.
That's interesting.
And GLP-1 is the phosphatase that removes those two serophosphates from the
cell. Oh, that's cool.
So I bet that what you have here is a exact same, that's a negative feedback loop.
That maintains
from P53 to MAP kinase.
Yeah.
You have the same negative feedback loop here.
Yeah.
Right? And 12% of breast cancers have amplified GLP-1.
Mm-hmm.
So they not only inactivate P53, they inactivate P38 MAP kinase through P53, and I bet they're going to inactivate FOXO.
Yeah.
So you're losing your stress, your oxidative stress responses, and you're raising the mutation rate.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. Yeah.
And it's actually through a common phosphatase.
Yeah, that's cool.
So that's a negative, P53 is on 11 different negative feedback loops.
Yeah.
Which keep regulating it down because it's dangerous and killed.
Mm-hmm.
And this then has exactly the same negative feedback.
Yeah.
Is this, so when you use oxidative stress, you immediately see junk go up? Or is that
what? So what we see, so junk is phosphorylating directly in vitro this site here, serine 425. And when we use oxidative stress, we use more UV for junk, so that I don't know if this is, but that's what we did. And then we use junk inhibitor, and we see that the phosphorylation induced by UV of this site is reduced when you have junk inhibitors.
That's and, the and is that true for the NAP kinase also?
So the P38 is actually under, for this site, it's not a direct site of P38, it's a site for MAPCAP kinase 2 that's induced by P38. And if you treat cells with H2O2, the ability of P38 to induce this site is reverted when you have the SB, whatever, P38 inhibitor.
Just to increase the combinatorial coding possibilities, is there any evidence that there's multiple variants of modified, say, FOXO3 in one cell?
This is a good point, and how do we know that those are on the same molecules, right? They could be on different molecules for all we know. I don't know how you would really address this question. It's hard to, I guess in super shift, you can probably see, like if you do EMSA and you use the antibody to super shift, you can sort of like see the stoichiometry by doing that. Otherwise, I think, I guess you can IP with one and come back with the other, but that still doesn't, I guess you could IP with one specific phospho and then come back with the other and see if the one that's decorated with one site is also decorated with the other site. So far we haven't done that, so it's still also possible that we have in the same cells, even under the same conditions, several types of molecules of phosphorylation and acetylation.
Just say a word about what, obviously, AKT is in this pathway of PI3 kinase, BDK1. SGK is serum glucocorticoid kinase.
Yes.
So there are other inputs, obviously.
Yes. So, yeah.
What are those inputs?
So what's interesting about SGK is sort of like it's the poor cousin of AKT in the sense that all the focus and attention has been put on AKT, but it's more for historical reasons in a way, because when people did the experiment in worms, it turns out that what AKT is important for is development, but what SGK is important for is lifespan. So AKT is dispensable for the lifespan phenotype in worms, and what's important is actually SGK. Now, SGK, it's regulated in two aspects. One, and it's recently been shown to be regulated by P53, albeit in an indirect way by the group of TACMAC, who published a PNAS paper. So let me back off 1 second. So SGK stands for serum and glucocorticoid-induced kinase. It's an immediate oligene that's induced by very strongly by glucocorticoid and also by serum. However, when it's induced by glucocorticoids, the mRNA and the protein gets up the roof, but it's completely inactive. So in a way, it could even act in this sense as a dominant negative because it's inducing a protein that's not active. What makes it active is the activation of insulin, PI3 kinase, and PDK1, and PDK1 phosphorylates SGK, and only under those circumstances is SGK activated. So what's been shown by the group of TACMAC was that P53, and I don't know if this is real or not, because it hasn't been reproduced yet, so P53 through the MAP kinase pathway is important to regulate SGK, and as such talks to the forkhead constituent factors. So there is this interaction. Actually, we are sort of like investigating the relationship between P53 and FOXO at several levels, like trying to understand if they like act together in synergy on target genes, or if they are epistatic, if one is upstream of the other in the network of the events. So we don't know yet. So what I would like to leave you with is this amazing conservation of those pathways that are important for longevity, with insulin, PI3 kinase, AKT, SGK, DAF16, that's both. I don't know if DAF16 itself is phosphorylated or acetylated, it's harder to do in worms, but at least the sites and the motif that surround those sites are conserved. SOR2 has been shown by the group of Granti to promote longevity in a manner in worms that's dependent on DAF16. In flies, FOXO is critical for stress resistance and longevity. The role of SOR2 has recently been shown by the group of Steve Helfand to be important also for longevity, but it's not known yet whether it's dependent on FOXO. And in mammals, this whole pathway is critical, at least for the insulin and IGF-1 for longevity, but the downstream part we've only shown for stress resistance, mostly because it's an easier readout. So there is this amazing conservation, but the burning question is still whether these transcription factors in mammals have a role in longevity, and that's what we are doing at the moment, making mouse models for FOXO transcription factors where we render them inactive, either by knockout, but we've started a whole strategy where we try to make them all at once inactive by an inducible shRNA strategy. And if the model is correct, they should, those mice should display even accelerated aging or at least suppress the longevity of long-lived mice, such as calotrophic mice. In the contrast, what we are making also is the knock-in of this inducible active form of FOXO3, the one that goes into the nucleus at will, try to see if the model is correct, that this induction of stress resistance is prolonged by induces the longevity. And because those mouse models, we are all trying to do it in a Cre-lox dependent way, we can also test which part of the body is critical to regulate longevity in a non-cell or non-organ autonomous. So it could be the immune system, but because this family is very abundant in the nervous system, and because the nervous system has been shown, both in worms, although Cynthia is always disagrees a little bit with that, but it has been shown in worms by the group of Gary Rifkin to be critical in the brain to control general longevity as well as in the fly. The question is, can this pathway be sufficient to function in the nervous system to control the longevity synchronously of all the organs? And are there, in addition to what it does at the cell autonomous level by regulating stress resistance of each of the cells, can it also regulate other factors? And if we do arrays, in those arrays, did we miss or did we were there the genes that we didn't know about and we didn't know to look for? Are there genes that are the longevity or aging factors that would be either neuropeptides or neurohormones that would be secreted in the entire body and could really maintain the synchronous, act as a pacemaker, where the brain could act as a pacemaker, if you wish, to maintain the longevity of the whole organism? So that's the sort of like more long-term aspects of my lab. So we are trying to determine the CNS, the central nervous system regions involved, and trying to identify if there are such longevity or aging factors. And the goal, maybe, I don't know, is to understand really the principles that are behind organismal longevity. And this is Jeanne Calment. She's dead now, but she's so far the oldest person that was recorded. There are probably older persons, but they weren't. They didn't have the exact record.
Birth certificate.
And what?
They didn't have the birth certificate.
Yes. So this is, so 100, she got to live 122. She said she smoked until 117. So
she had a glass, and she's French. She had a glass of red wine every day.
Exactly. So the red wine,
yes.
Go. Maybe that's the longevity factor. And I'd like to just end by.
You might have to think it though.
Yeah. Probably a fun one. And I'd like to thank the people in my lab. So Dan, Matt, Eric are three of the rotation students. I have six total now. And Philo Scu is a research assistant, and Ophelia Venturini is a undergrad who works with me, and we are having fun starting up. So thank you very much for your attention.